And let's begin with those film reviews tonight. And Donald Clark and Arlene Hunt have been on an exciting adventure, walking the southwestern coast of England with Gillian Anderson and Jason Isaacs in Salt Path. And they've been up the slopes of Utah with a quartet of tech bros to stop them ruining the world in Mountainhead. And they've ended up on a concert for one on a remote Welsh island on the estranged folk duo Maguire and Martin in the Ballad of Wallace Island. Welcome back to Donald and Arlene after your trek. And Donald, you from Cannes.
Mm-hmm, lovely indeed, yes. That I'm still slightly dazed from the experience.
Now, Salt Path is based on the 2018 book of the same name written by Rainer Wynn, which describes the imploding of the lives of her husband, Moth, and herself. Can you bring us into the reason they go on this? Is it 640-mile trek?
No, actually, to be honest, I can't really. If there's a flaw with this film, I don't quite get the explanation as to why they decide to walk on this historic pathway, the southwest coastal path that leads you through Devon and the west country of England. I mean, the background is that they lose their house in this financial meltdown that they've taken advice from a friend, and that went badly. They sued them, and that went badly. And so they find themselves essentially middle-class homeless people. And then Moth...
And they're kind of middle-aged middle-class homeless people, aren't they?
Yeah. And then Moth is diagnosed with a rare neurodegenerative disease called cortical basal or basal degeneration, which I don't know about, which is potentially fatal. And so they make this decision to kind of like find themselves going on this enormous walk. And I think one of the flaws of the film, I don't quite understand the logic behind this. Obviously, I can see that it's an interesting thing, actually, that there are a whole series of memoirs about people who go on these walks, which help them find themselves in times of distress. There was Reese Witherspoon was in an adaptation of that of the book called Wild about 10 or 15 years ago. Maya Wasikowska was in Tracks, where she walked all the way across Australia. And so there's a whole kind of genre of these things. But I think in those films, they made a better attempt at explaining why they went on the adventure in the first place. That criticism said, I think they make it live, these two actors. I mean, they're very strong actors, and I think Gillian Anderson is at her best when there is a strip of steel or iron, in the case of Margaret Thatcher, for The Crown.
There's
a strip of iron down her character, and you get a sense of a determined and flinty person here who is going to batter her way through these crises. And Jason Isaac, I think, is always charming, and I think it's good to give him a role here where he has a degree of vulnerability, because he is quite a positive and aggressive actor a lot of the time.
Okay.
And I think they work with those limitations very nicely.
And let's hear that steel now from Gillian Anderson in this clip from the film. So we have Moth, played by Jason Isaacs, and Rainer, played by Gillian Anderson. And they meet a stranger called Paul, played by Paul Morell, and they explain why they're walking.
You're carrying some weight there.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you going?
Lamb's End?
Oof, that's a long old hike.
Yeah.
You're as young as you feel.
Right.
Time on your hands, eh?
Yeah, no deadlines.
Retired, are you? Yeah.
Homeless, actually. Yeah, we lost a home.
There we have Jason Isaacs there playing playing Moth, explaining why they're on this trek. So you would think some place called the Salt Path, Arlene, would be some place rather staid and serene, but that's not the case.
No, it is actually a 640-mile hike from Minehead to Poole, and it's England's longest uninterrupted pathway, and they have a book and they're following somebody else who's the author of the book that they have?
Oh, the guy, I don't know.
Saint Pat.
Well, Patrick Fermer, is it?
And I'm not sure. No. I think, he's called Saint Pat a few times here by Moth because,
yes, it's their Bible getting them along the path.
And this is a journey he had taken. It's quite complicated because you go over, it's on land, obviously, but you're going through woodland, you're going through quite mountainous regions, and you're always quite close to the sea. And that's why it's called the Salt Path, I suppose. But a lot of the film is shot with drones, and you're shot from overhead with drone footage, and you can see how rugged the terrain is, how difficult the terrain is. And they go during summertime, and they're lucky in a certain respects. The weather is relatively forgiving. But on the occasions when it is not forgiving, when the fog rolls in and a storm comes in very quickly, you can see how it goes from being like a jaunt to the beautiful countryside to kind of a hellscape.
Now, Moth is suffering from degenerative illness that Donald was talking about. So is that an issue in the film?
Yes, it is, because he gets tired and they can only go so many miles a day when he has to rest. And you can see the physical strain it takes on him as the longer they walk, because, you know, they're not going to, this is not flat concrete. This is climbing hills and a lot of rocky terrain. And there's points in it where he becomes absolutely just physically and mentally drained, and he cannot go on, and they have to set up a camp, and it could be in the middle of a bog, or it could be right on where the ocean meets the land, and it's everything is technical, and they've no lights, and you've got two middle-aged couple traipsing around the middle of the British countryside with nothing else except one another.
So let's listen to another clip from The Salt Path. Here Moth and Ray stop for a rest during their hike along the path.
Moth.
Where are we?
I think the Castle Rock.
Which is where?
It's King Arthur's country.
Crikey.
Yeah, it's impressive. You okay?
Yeah. Oh. You should take me back to the shop and get a different one.
I don't want a different one.
So it was obviously, Donald, based on a very lovable memoir. How does that translate to the screen? Do you get the power of the love between the couple? And then are they on a journey of discovery for themselves as well?
Yes. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing. I think I mentioned those other films earlier on, and there does seem to be one reliable way of getting your memoir made into a film is to make it a journey of self-discovery, because then it becomes a kind of self-help book, and then that becomes a kind of self-help film. And that seems to be a very significant market for self-help films. People who, when they approach a film, think, well, what do I get out of this? And I'm not sure you will get that much out of it in those terms of learning about yourself and learning lessons that will guide you through life's own salt path. I don't think you get as much that I would have expected. For me, it's more kind of an amusing picaresque journey through the picturesque west of England. And I think it's amusing as well that those other books I talked about and other films I talked about, like Wild and Tracks, I mean, they're fighting like, you know, killer snakes and monsoons and typhoons. And none of that here, obviously. You have the inconveniences that Arlene just talked about, and that can be very uncomfortable, particularly if you are not a well man. But for the most part, it's a fairly, very, very English, very relaxing journey, despite the fact the inconveniences that they face, characterised by at one stage, he is mistaken for Simon Armitage, the poet laureate.
All right, who wrote a book about the area.
And it was apparently walking it at that particular time. It was publicised, so these kind of poshos meet him and think he's Simon Armitage, and that's not the sort of thing you encounter in an American version of these stories.
So, Arlene, stars out of five from you, and did it work for you?
I liked it. I thought it was quite a gentle film. There was a point in it as well, which I thought we should maybe just have a quick chat. And it was just about how they were let down by everyone. They were let down by the government. They were let down by social care. They were let down by absolutely everyone. And they only had one another. They had one friend, Polly, who they could leave their stuff with, and who kind of treats them as sort of secondary citizens at some point. And they were let down by everybody. And I liked the stoical way that they went on about what they did. And I liked their journey. So I gave it a 4 out of 5. I liked it. I enjoyed it.
4 out of 5. And you, Donald?
3.5 out of 5.
3.5. Yeah. That's for Salt Path. Now on to The Ballad of Wallace Island. Here we're in Wales. And it's a project of the comedian Tim Key and Tom Baston that began life as a short film. The one and only Herb Maguire plays Wallace Island in 2007. So why do you think, Arlene, they went back to the short film to make a feature film?
I just imagine they wanted to flesh it out because the characters are very entertaining in this. And, you know, I think Tim Kaye in particular, you know, these characters have been living at him for a long time. And I think once the opportunity arose to flesh it out and, you know, they have Kerry Mulligan in this and that adds a certain amount of, you know, star power and firepower to it. And if they can use her in this, I don't see why they wouldn't, you know, because they've got more money together now to and make a production of this. And Americans will lap this up. I just have no doubt about it. So, you know, why not?
OK, so tell us about Charlie's plan to bring this wonderful folk duo back to the island.
OK, so Charlie is an eccentric multi-winner of the lottery. Well, twice. But, you know, so he's a strange man. He's a bit awkward. He's a super fan of the group. He had been a super fan of the group with his partner, Marie, and had gone to like their concerts long before the group themselves had split up. The duo had split up.
This is Maguire Mortimer.
Yes. And it's coming up to the anniversary of Marie's death. She's been gone for 5 years and he has the money to do it. And he lives on this remote island. So he thought to himself, what better way to celebrate her anniversary of her death than to bring the duo together to perform for a concert on the island. But what he doesn't mention is he does say to Herb that it'll be for an audience of less than 100. What he doesn't mention is the audience is just him. So, but he hasn't lied technically, but the audience is just him. And so the only way to get to the island is by a very small motorboat. There's no harbour, so you have to hop off the side of the boat and wade through the water to get up to the actual pebble beach. And so Herb arrives and it's all very awkward for the time being. And then Herb, but there's a lot of money at stake here, I should point out. Herb is getting $500,000 to play this one gig for one night. And Herb wants to use that money to finance a solo album that he's doing himself.
He's moved on.
Correct, he's moved on. What Charles neglected to mention to Herb was that he had also got in touch with Nell, who is the other singer from the group.
Mortimer.
And that she is also coming to the island. And also, you know, then we learn that Nell and Herb are actually estranged and had not spoken to each other for years. So they're arriving on this really remote island to play a gig for an eccentric millionaire. And so, as you can imagine, it all
and
goes
And this eccentric millionaire, wrong. Donald, could be seen as rather creepy. He luring this this couple, this duo, this
luring is a good verb to use. Yeah, I mean, everyone's great in this. I did like this a lot as well. But I think Tim Kaye, who people remember as sidekick Simon to Alan Partridge,
who is creepy.
But they're both creepy in that version of Alan Partridge. But I think he deserves special praise for somehow giving us a borderline stalker super fan who just about stays the right side of creepy, just about.
He's a chatterbox.
Well, I think that's what it is. Yes, that helps the fact that he always finds the wrong joke. And always deliver, and it's a great gift that Tim Kaye has for someone who's a very successful comedian, that he's very good at getting the timing wrong.
Yeah, in this. Yes, 100%.
So, I mean, the punchline always hits at exactly the wrong point. But I think there's one point where they almost push it over the edge, which is when he reveals that he has paid for a lock of Kerry Mulligan's hair. And, ooh, I don't know about that. Yeah. That really does sound retributing to something deeply sinister. Those are the actions of a man who might, in the style of kind of John Fowles' The Collector, imprison you in his basement. But I think the awareness of his grief just about keeps you on board. He gets a degree of pathos running that awful inability to land the right joke.
But that doesn't stop him for being a bit of a pain.
He's a pain, all right, yeah.
Where Charles and Nell and Herb, this is the duet, are enjoying the sunset, or trying to enjoy the sunset, but Charles just won't stop talking.
And plop. There she goes. To paraphrase the Beatles, there goes the sun. Fan of the Beatles, Herb?
Can we just...
Oh, I bet you are.
Watch the sunset.
I bet you bloody are.
Yes, I like the Beatles. Let's watch the sunset, OK?
We were lucky enough once to see the bootleg Beatles.
Brilliant.
You seen them, Herb? Something else, tight as a drum.
OK.
Hit after hit.
Can we just please...
Can we just please appreciate this damn sunset?
Yeah, he just won't let people enjoy themselves. We've agreed that Charles is a very good character, but what about Kerry Mulligan and Bastian as the duo? Are they believable, Arlene?
Yeah, because they have it. Both of them carry a lot of charm themselves, there's moments, quiet moments when Charles is not around. Quiet moments where they share their experiences, but they.
And are they? Do they slowly begin to rekindle their friendship?
But this is not a traditional rom-com in the way that you expect a rom-com to go. So, because Herb is carrying a lot of baggage. Like, he's carrying a lot of baggage. And, he had gone off to do a solo album. And in many ways, Nell has moved on far, far further than Herb ever has, even though Herb still has the musical career.
She's making chutney
she's
in Portland.
She's making chutney in Portland. And she's married again and her husband is on the island with her. And it's clear that she has her own life and is living her own life, however way she's living it. But Herb is kind of caught in between like who he was and who he wants to be. And he finds it very... You can see this is a man struggling, so... when he's trying to kind of reconnect with the past, it's because he hasn't made anything of the present. And so that kind of changes the dynamic between them enormously, even though it's very charming the way they talk back and forth to one another.
I see, Donald, here people trying to weigh up, will we go to Salt Path or will we go to The Ballad of Wallace Island?
Oh, I'd say Wallace Island, definitely. I think this is a great film. And I think it's original, but at the same time, it fits into a kind of tradition of British and specifically English cinema. I mean, there's something of local hero about it, which obviously is a Scottish film, but there's a degree of local hero in it, of the charm that you find in eccentric people in remote locations. But also, I think there's a little bit of Michael Powell's I Know Where I'm Going. I sort of felt a little bit about of Kerry Mulligan in the position of Wendy Hiller in that film. I mean, one reservation I had maybe, and this is always so difficult to get right, is the band plausible? I mean, is there somebody they could be in real life? And I think just about, there's a terrible fear they might be a variation on the awful Mumford and Sons, and I don't say that just because Kerry Mulligan is married to a Mumford.
Did you have to say awful?
Married to a Mumford, so Marcus Mumford. But I think they are plausible. They're from about the right era. There's a sort of hint of kind of, the legacy of Nick Drake about them. They're a quieter, more reflective act than the Mumfords, for example. And I could just about buy the fact that this, but it helps that they weren't enormous.
And how many stars out of 5 would you give it, Donald?
I give it a comfortable 4.
4. And you, Arlene?
I gave it a rock solid 4. I found it has no business being as charming as it is, and yet it is.
All right. So that seems to be the thumbs up there for The Ballad of Wallace Island. Now, Succession's Jesse Armstrong's first film, Mountainhead, could be said to be a film for our time, this very time we're living in. 4 tech billionaires gather together in a snow lodge in Utah to compare the size of their bank balances. But one amongst them, Venus, has put in motion a nation-destabilizing cyber drop. Arlene, you've seen this. So can you tell us about the 4 tech bros that are gathered in
4
this?
4 horsemen of the apocalypse.
This snow lodge in Utah.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got 4 giants, plutocrats of technology who arrive at this vast monstrosity of a cabin in the high mountain region in Utah. They arrive, by helicopter and by Escalade, and they've been invited there by one of the guys, Soup, and he's called Soup because he's the poorest of the 4. So the men refer to him as Soup Kitchen, which is, that'll give you an idea.
Yes, at one stage they're out of the snow and they have to write how many billions they have.
And he doesn't. He only has 500 million plus. So he's the poor cousin in this group. So of the 4, you have Steve Carell's, he's playing Randall, and he's like, if you were to put them into real life character, he's a Peter Thiel kind of guy. They call him the Papa Bear of the group. Yes. And then they have Venus, and then he is clearly modelled on Elon Musk. He's that tech guy. He's a little bit odd. He's a little bit strange. He's got quirks and foibles. And, he's just an odd fellow. Aside from Soup, then you've got Jeff, who is, I want to say he's the voice of consciousness of the group. I want to say that. But he is also a billionaire, and he also has, tendencies of billionaires, which is to look out for May Fane, number one.
Yes, and he's using AI, and he's got...
Venus who's using AI, and the start of the movie is what happens, and what the premise of the movie is Venus has released AI onto social platform mediums, so anyone and everyone can suddenly then do deep fakes, create all kinds of global like catastrophes, because you can make anything look real, and you can make any scene look real, and you can make any atrocity look real, in which case that you can rile up people on both sides of every divide.
And yes, and he floods the internet hating each other and killing each other.
And so for the start of this weekend, they all have their phones out. The broskies, the guys, they're there for a haze kind of weekend, you know, where they want to play poker and take drugs and just hang out. But that's not really, as soon as they arrive, because the AI was released that morning, their phones, they are glued to their phones for the whole weekend. And you can see in real time the atrocities that are going on, and governments falling. The mayor of Paris is hung. You know, it's just like all kinds of things are going on. But Venus, who's watching all of this, is like giddy with, you know, the possibilities of what they can do with this power, and how they can change and alternate and how they can, you know, guide the world. It's progress. It's progressive. It's this, it's that, et cetera. And actually, it's just atrocities that they have manufactured.
So if Jesse Armstrong is writing, you know that it is going to be witty banter. And we'll just hear a clip from it where Randall and Jeff, that's Steve. We're going to hear a clip with Ven, played by Corey Michael Smith. He arrives at the lodge and there's tension in the air as he and Jeff, that's played by Rami Youssef, meet up.
Venn diagram.
Can we hug it out?
Yeah, buddy. Of course. Good to see you.
Bring it up.
Ooh. Oh, man. Watch out. Don't crush me with all that founder energy.
Ah, I was misquoted.
How could you be misquoted if you said it? Who cares? I don't even remember. Now it feels right. Hey, the Fed called me. They call you? Are we worried about this Italy thing?
No need for concern over any country with an exportable cheese.
As in?
No country with an internationally traded consumer cheese has ever defaulted on its national debt.
Wow!
Blah, blah, blah.
Classic Randall.
No,
200 IQ?
That's good. You look so good.
Why are you being weird?
Yes.
I'm just saying you look great. That's all. I mean, obviously this launch shit's delivering a lot of torque to your airframe.
No. Hardcore gravy, we're all lubed up, you know? But have we seen what Founder Jeff is doing? Your net worth must be like 2x in the last 24.
I mean, it's only because of, you know, all the fucking deads from your launch.
Oh, oh, ouch! Oh,
your shitty stock to the moon.
Heart talk! Oh. Oof. Here, guys, take it to the ring. Take it to the ring. Sit down. Come on, sit down.
Yeah, that is hard.
Sit soft. I think we were all getting a bit embarrassed about countries that export cheese and might have problems with their loans.
Yeah, Cork just went off the face of the map. Yeah, so they talk like this a lot in the early two-thirds. These men are friends the way Kodiak bears pre-hibernation are friends. They're all out for what they want to get. They all hate each other. That's as clear as day in this. They have so many issues with one another, but they try to keep it together because they're all in the same boat. It's interesting, Jeff... the reason why they're kind of touchy-feely with each other, him and Venice, is because they were in a startup together and they split. And so that's why the whole founder digs at one another. Mm-hmm. But Jeff has got and developed a technology which can be sold on the market so that when you get it, you can show what is and what is not fake for AI. And this technology breaks down what is and is not fake. So, you know, V would really like for Jeff to sell him that. But in the meantime, with everything that's going on, Jeff's technology is rising. And there's a really interesting clip of this where I'm not going to give a spoiler, but where he surpasses somebody else in wealth. And that scene is the most tense scene where he just goes, oh, look, my stock has just risen. So it's a dramatic film. It undermines everything about them.
Yes. And then, of course, they start to turn on each other even more.
Well, it was never going to be a gentle picnic between the four of them.
Okay, stars out of 5 from you for Mountain Head.
I gave it 3 because the premise is really interesting, and the idea of having these people stuck together in a small room like that when everything in the world is exploding is really interesting. But the film changes. I'm very conscious of not giving away plot, but the film changes in the third and become something completely different. So, and for that alone, if they had gone with the sort of the arrogance and the drive and everything mm-hmm. that they started and the great snappy dialogue, I would have thought it was a higher film, but I'm giving it a 3.
Okay, 3 out of 5 for Mountainhead. Donald Clark and Arlene Hunt, thank you so much. Salt Path, The Ballad of Wallace Island are on general release, and Mountainhead is available on Sky and Now. Nutbush City Limits, not only a great banger of a song, but also the name of the town in Tennessee where Anna Mae Bullock was born, the woman who went on to become the queen of rock and roll, Tina Turner. The hit stage musical, which bears her name, Tina, opened in Dublin last night, starring Bree Smith as Tina. The musical offers us the anthems, the strut, the hair and the glitter, but also the compelling story of the woman born in the segregated southern states of America who suffered more than her share of abuse and violence on her way to being Tina Turner. Kellyanne Byrne has been to see the show and joins me now.
Yeah.
It's an important anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah, we were just speaking. So actually, it was her anniversary on the 24th. 2 years since she passed away. I think I was in here with you guys talking about that when she did pass away, because I'm a massive fan of hers. And 2 years since she's gone.
Now, the musical comes with the seal of approval of Tina Turner.
Absolutely.
And those who would expect to go for music, as I say, you get mm-hmm. that, you get the costumes, you get a great, huge production.
Yeah.
But you also get the real gritty story.
You do. It doesn't shy away from, you know, as we all know, her story is one of resilience and defiance. And it doesn't shy away from her relationship with Ike Turner, which was extremely violent and mentally, emotionally abusive. It also goes back to her childhood when she was Anna Mae Bullock, as you mentioned, growing up in Tennessee. Very traumatic childhood. Her parents had a very volatile marriage. Both were abusive. They abandoned her when she was very young and she was left to the care of her grandmother. So it steps into all of that and then takes us up to the moment where she met Ike Turner in St. Looney, where she cajoles him to go on stage and sing with him. But I loved that about the production, that it really, really, really goes into the nitty gritty.
Yes, and even though there is music all the time, it really makes time for the drama. You get to know the family members, you get to see the kitchen, the setting around the kitchen table.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of my favourite moments in the production was at the very beginning, and I know you were there last night as well, where she's picking cotton in the fields and they're like kind of chanting and the choreography is beautiful. And I just loved those moments and I loved the young Tina Turner, who was Chitsaram, I have to mention her name. I loved the way they went back into her childhood like that, because that made her a fighter, you know?
Now, she went to St. Louis then, and this is mm-hmm. where she meets Ike
Turner.
And tell us, what was Ike at that stage? He was fairly established. He had his own band.
Absolutely. He'd released a massive hit record called Rocket 88, and he was a big deal in St. Louis. And what he would do is he would get women up on stage every night to sing. And, you know, as we saw last night, a lot of them were airheads and they were crap. But Tina was dying to go on, and she goes up and he is frozen at how talented she is. And he says, "I've just met the female Little Richard." He cannot believe that this husky voice comes from this tiny little woman. And that's the moment that changed her life forever. In some awful ways, as we know, because of what he did to her. And then in some amazing ways, because she became a massive star.
Yes, because he was a womanizer. He really treated her so badly.
Yeah.
And then there's the violence, which they do not shy away from.
No, they don't.
Show.
They don't shy away from. They don't shy away from that at all. And I think the production really stays with you for that reason. Like, I've been thinking back on it today a lot. And I've been thinking on the moment when she escapes from Ike, where she actually, for the first time in her life, fights back in the back of a limo. And they're about to perform in Dallas. And she runs across the highway. She has 36 cents in her pocket. And she asks the hotel, "Please, can I stay here? My name is Tina Turner. I'll repay you for the rest of my life." And I thought that scene where Brie was by herself and it's like blood all over her face and her nightgown was incredible.
Now, we must say that the David King Yombo plays Ike, and he is, even though he's a sinister character, you can still see the charm, you
yes,
can see the pizzazz
yeah.
about him.
I thought he was excellent. For me, he was a standout because you could see how she fell for him. You know, it was like, in ways, I kind of felt sorry for him in many, many ways. He was such an insecure person and very jealous of her and jealous of the fact that she was his meal ticket, you know. She brought in all the money. But I did think he was excellent in the role. I thought he really looked like him as well.
Now, we're going to play a little bit of River Deep, Mountain High, because there's a very good scene with Phil Spector, Tina and Dyke.
Yeah.
When I was a little girl, I had a breakdown. Only...
River Deep, Mountain High. And Kellyanne, yeah, there was a great scene where she meets Phil Spector with Ike. Ike, of course, thinks it's Ike and Tina,
yeah,
but Phil has other ideas.
Yeah, he comes in being his usual uber controlling self, and Phil Spector is like, sorry, you're not in this picture. And he famously paid him $20,000 to stay away because he said, I'm interested in Tina. I'm not interested in Ike and Tina. And that was really, I think, the first step towards freedom for her. And she has said in the documentary that I watched about her, she felt like a bird let out of a cage because Ike was trying to make her sing this particular way. And then when she met Phil Spector, if there was more freedom there, she could be herself more. I think that, and then her introduction to Buddhism afterwards, were the two steps towards getting awake from Ike.
Well, now, and also what was interesting with the Phil Spector thing was this wall of sound that Spector is so famous for.
Yeah.
And she again, does, you know, is wondering where the band is. But, you know, this happens a few times to her, this difference between, I suppose, rhythm and blues and then going into the more rock world.
Yeah, because she wanted to be a rock and roll star. And when she eventually broke away from Mike, she said, I'm going to be one of the biggest rock and roll stars in the world. And she never gave up on that. Even though when she got away from him, it was extremely difficult for her.
How do you think they incorporate her songs into the show? Let's, for example, is it towards the end of Act One, we have Private Dancer.
Yeah, Private Dancer, which was her solo record and obviously sold millions. And yeah, I mean, look, one of the main characters of the show is the music. You know, the music is just fabulous. And I think we should give special mention to the band, actually, led by Sarah Burrell. And I thought all of the performances were just fantastic and the vocals were fantastic. And yeah, it's the music that you...
Yes, and Private Dancer is quite a nice set piece in the show. Private Dancer there. This is a real story of female empowerment, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How did the audience react to Tina?
Okay, there were people. So for the first act, there were people sobbing around me. And then in the toilet, I don't know if you felt the same, I met people and everybody was crying because, you know, it's the first act is very, very sad. But then by the second, I think when we see she becomes one of the biggest solo stars in the world, at the age of 50, she played to 180,000 people in Rio, which was the most tickets ever sold by a solo artist at that point. She had been told, you know, where's Ike? You're never going to be anything without Ike. You're a middle-aged black woman in this industry. You're never going to go anywhere. And she defied all the odds. And that's what this story, what makes the story so incredible.
Yes, and a key guy in all of this is the Australian producer, Roger Davis, who gave Olivia Newton-John a number one with Let's Get Physical.
Yeah.
And he wanted Tina as, not as his next project, he just adored her and but saw her as a rock singer.
Yeah, and he never gave up on her. And he's played by, we must mention because he was brilliant, Isaac Elder. He added a lot of humour to the show, but he never gave up on her. When he met her first in Las Vegas, he thought, well, okay, how can I market her? And he introduced her to What's Love Got to Do With It. And she said, I can't touch that song. It was originally sung by Bucks Fizz. And it was this pop, cheesy record. And she said, no, 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 no.
And yes, and there's a great scene where the techies are singing and improvising around the song. And she just wants nothing to do with it.
She wants nothing to do with it. And he persists. And then she says, OK, if you can let me tune it up and put my stamp on it. And when you hear the original, as we did last night, and then what she did with that song, it's phenomenal.
Phenomenal. And it builds up to a wonderful finale, which touches on what you said about the Rio concert.
Yeah, the Rio concert was to 186,000 people. She had said, I'm going to be as big as the Stones and David Bowie and I'm going to sell out these stadiums. And she did. She realised that dream. And it's simply the best that she sings at the end.
And this is not in any way, I mean, there is so much money in this. There is so much beautiful lighting, beautiful staging, and a huge band.
Yeah, I thought the set design was gorgeous. That's Mark Thompson. And I also thought the lighting by Bruno Poet was fabulous. There were some really beautiful scenes.
And Bree Smith, who plays the older Tina, how did you think she did?
I thought she did a great job. Yeah, and especially in the second act, she was electrifying. Yeah.
Well, I think you're recommending it, Kellyanne.
Yes, everybody go. It's fab.
Well, Kellyanne Byrne, thank you so much. Tina Turner, the musical, runs at the Bord Gáis Theatre until June the 14th. The wren, the wren, the king of all birds, on Stephen's day was caught in the furze. It's a rhyme that skips off the tongue, but the artist Amanda Coogan, the wren caught in the furze bush, has a historic reference and a resonance that she's explored in her new show, Caught in the Furze, which she will perform for 5 hours a day for 7 days at the Cork Midsummer Festival. This kind of endurance performance is nothing for Amanda, who has been performing with one of her close collaborators, Marina Abramovich's work. She lived in the Royal Academy Gallery for 12 days with no food. I hope you're not doing that in Cork. I hope you're getting a bit of food.
I think I'll probably have a little bit of food in between.
So where are you performing in Cork?
I'm performing in Cork in the Glucksmann have an off-site that they use for the festival. It's the CCA, Cork College of Architecture. Beautiful room. I think Tamsin Snow was there a couple of years ago, installed there a couple of years ago. So really beautiful architectural room, white cube, like a gallery space, really. And I'm hanging furze bushes upside down off the ceiling in there because you can do those things in there. I'm so excited. I'm literally just come up from Cork where I was walking the fields with the brilliant artist and photographer, Miriam O'Connor, looking at furze bushes, putting our hand in them, see which ones were sparky or spiky and smelly and long. And there was some beautiful leggy ones and there was tiny little baby ones. So really all pre-installation at this stage and really gathering it together.
So the inspiration for this is the Curra and the women, a group of women who in the 19th century lived in the Curra, but in terrible conditions.
It's an incredible story, these wrens of the Curra. And we know about it because a journalist from the Pall Mall Gazette in London came over and he wrote a kind of diary about what was happening. He went into the nests. So these group of homeless women kind of came together around the army barracks in the Curra.
Are we talking like pre-famine or famine times?
I beg your pardon, around the famine times, around mid-19th century. And they all lived in the middle of the furze bushes. Now this, like as an artist who loves things, you know, this is incredible, like it blows my head. They worked as prostitutes for the army.
So and this would have been the British Army.
The British Army
was
those
there,
times, yeah. Absolutely. And as I say, there's loads of witness accounts. What happened, how I got extraordinarily interested in them is I was commissioned by Rua Red a good number of years ago to look at the figure of Mary Magdalene. And these Curra wrens were closed down and they were all sent to a lock hospital because they had venereal diseases. And I suppose part of the job, I'm trying to be
probably, yes,
I'm trying to say something.
No surprise.
And these lock hospitals became Magdalene laundries. So that's the stepping stone in that way. But then, I made an exhibition around these that I called They Come Then, the Birds. And so this is kind of the second iteration, very clearly looking at these women. But I believe that any kind of homeless woman living on the streets around Ireland were called wrens. The nickname was wrens. Then I was really curious, you know, as you do as an artist, scratch into these fabulous ideas. And as you say, the rhyme, the wren, the king of the birds, on Stephen's day was caught in the furze. Her clothes were all torn. Her shoes were all worn. Up the kettle and down the pan, give us a penny to bury the wren. And I was just struck by these two lines that are sometimes kept in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these rhymes change from place to place. her clothes were all torn and her shoes were all worn. And then we have this intangible history of calling homeless women or women who've fallen on hard times in whatever capacity. And
so
we
do
don't
think
know
it might have come from that time. Or maybe imposed on them because they were living rough.
I'm musing. Mm-hmm. I'm an artist. I'm not a researcher. Mm-hmm. Part of being an artist is to go down these fabulous glory holes and daydream mm-hmm. around them. Mm-hmm. And so,
and do wrens live in furze bushes?
Oh, absolutely, hopping in and out of them all mm-hmm. the time. Yeah, mm-hmm. and then there's all these stories about furze bushes. You know, they grow wild. You know, in April, as we're driving down the motorway in this incredible yellow coverage, and then within a couple of weeks they're gone brown and gnarly, and as I was looking at them yesterday, bits are green, bits are brown, bits are kind of burnt umber, like glorious. And K, the smell. So I'm so excited for the audience to come into the gallery and get the olfactory smell of these furze bushes.
So is the place going to be packed with furze bushes? You said you're putting them on walls, or is it just that they are so powerfully and pungent?
I this is the plan, Kay. I start actually installing next week. I was like a child in the sweet shop yesterday going, ooh, could you cut that one? Could you get that one? So we'll see. We'll see how it is. No, but I think that they have an awful lot of presence. They feel to me like other people.
Right. You know. And you're going to be performing in the middle of
so
this.
So I'm there in the middle of it. And this is a solo piece. I've been gloriously doing a lot of group work with different performers and group works over the last while. And actually last year in Midsummer's, they brought down my Teresa Diva opera. And the year before that, I made the Beethoven's Ode to Joy in sign language. So actually they've beautifully kind of coming full circle with me and ask me to come back to the centrality of my practice, which is solo me, or as my lovely husband would say, this is free jazz Coogan, because it's me in duration. So 5 hours a day for 7 days. So this incredible 35 hours of performance, where of course I go in and I have lots of choices of actions that I have been dreaming up in the studio, but I don't know how they're going to sit, where they're going to sit, which place they're going to be. So I am following the audience, following the shape of the room as it goes and as it goes and as it goes. So who knows? And it's really important to me that it's an exhibition in flux. And this is what duration will do, this endurance idea, this duration idea, because we can fall into flow, or I can show all my sweets and juggle all my balls that I've prepared in my studio. And that'll last an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then you have to dig deeper. And then you have to dig deeper. And really, I've done as I say, the kind of core of my work is durational endurance
work.
Yes,
because I'm recalling Yellow, for example, which about the Magdalene.
The Magdalene.
Lawneries. Mm-hmm. And there you are dressed in yellow and you are constantly scrubbing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
As though you are, you know, propelled because you are stuck in this laundry, presumably.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that's the entree for the viewer, presumably. And then they go deeper.
Yeah, it's like repetition is such an interesting thing. So with Yellow and certainly with Cotton the Furs, I will be repeating and looping. And something happens when you're witnessing something, because of course it's never the same. It's never, you can never step in the river in the same place at the same time. So this recalibration, I think, is a really rich place to look at. And as you say, maybe 18 months ago, I re-performed Marina Abramovich's House with the Ocean View, which was this 12-day durational endurance piece of work.
Yes, just describe what that was like, because it's kind of a house within the gallery space.
It's an installation in the gallery space which has, I say, you know, very much in inverted commas and coughing, a bathroom, a bedroom, a living room. Now, the bed was like a table, just a piece of wood. The chairs, all the furniture literally gave me bruises there. So inconvenient. The shower spilt all over the place. Space.
And your exit would be through a ladder made of knives. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
So you wouldn't be going down that way.
Elevated from the floor, from the viewer. And the access points are these three ladders that are laced with knives, the sharp end pointing up to you, so you can't get up or get down.
And how many hours was that?
12 days.
12 days?
12 days, yeah.
Open to the public?
Yes.
So they could
not
come
24
in.
Hours a day. Now the public, it was in the Royal Academy, and I think their opening hours are like 10 to 6 or something like that, 10 to 8 on a Friday or whatever it was. Mm.
And now I know that Marina Abramović is not averse to inflicting pain on herself in her work. And I think of you with a room of furze bushes. Is there going to be pain?
Well, I've promised the stage manager that there won't be any blood. I think the health and safety checks. I think, now, joking aside, keeping the danger in these performances is extremely important. So with live art,
keeping the danger.
Yeah, keeping it dangerous. Keeping a frisson. So whether, of course, I'm going to be putting my hands in the furze bushes, I'm going to be moving them, shaping them. I have little baby furs in prams, which I'll be wheeling around, and there'll be secret things hidden in the prams that I'll be taking out and playing with or showing with the audience.
Because I presume, going back to the women of the Curragh, the wens of the Curragh, presumably there were babies.
Yeah, and they shared the domesticity, seemingly. Like older women, older wrens looked after the inevitable children that came, and the younger, cleaner ones went out to work, and they shared everything. Seemingly, it seems like a matriarchal.
But still living in
dream.
This filthy squalor, yes.
In the middle of furze bushes. It's crazy. And these furze bushes are, you know, sometimes said to guard the entrance to the underworld. And you can imagine the underworld in the mythical, but also the underworld into the whatever underworld pursuits might be going on. I mean, it's so rich. I'm so excited to hop into it, and I'm so terrified.
Yes, yes, we're scared for you. Amanda Coogan, thank you so much. Cork Midsummer's Festival at the Glucksmann presents a 7-day durational performance by Amanda Coogan at the Cork Centre for Architectural Education. Cut in the Furs is a 7-day performance within an immersive installation of furs or gorse bushes by the artist. And that runs from June the 14th to the 21st and is from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. every day at the Cork Centre for Architectural Education. The website is corkmidsummer.com. Amanda Coogan, thank you so much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy. Liam Mullen was on sound. Alex Lupitan is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Shannon Gorman, and John Creedon is next after the news at 8.